From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, reporter Marty Michelson updates us on the Milwaukee streetcar and the arguments of critics and supporters.
We think it's going to be a change, but it's a change that people will become accustomed to. Again, the tracks are there. Cars can drive over these tracks. Obviously, we've had a few issues with bicyclists or motorcyclists.
Later, how seniors and their adult children can make plans to let them age in place.
We'll learn about the ceramic side of musician Alberto Villalobos.
Before a piece is fired, it's very fragile. It can crumble back to the ground. And once it's fired, it lasts for forever. You know, we found pieces from the Olmecs, from the Egyptians, and they're still there.
And Bubbler Talk goes the extra mile to answer a question about a Milwaukee area road. Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. In just a couple of months, the HOP, Milwaukee's new streetcar system, will be up and running. The project has been in development for years, and proponents have high hopes for its success.
But critics have big concerns, and they're voicing them, even before the streetcar gives rides to its very first passengers. WUWM's Marty Michelson has done a number of stories about the streetcar and is here with an update.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, remind us just what the Milwaukee streetcar is.
Well, it's important to note that the streetcar isn't a new concept in Milwaukee. History buffs and people who lived here before the 1960s might be aware that for decades, Milwaukee had an electric streetcar system. In fact, the city was an early player in the streetcar game in the U.S. The system was operational from 1890 to 1958. A couple years ago, I did a series on the past and future of the streetcar. I talked to We Energy's historian, Tim Brown. He told us that during the city's industrial boom, Milwaukee needed a streetcar system to carry people to jobs.
It really expanded opportunities for everyone in the area by being able to get to employment from where they live.
The streetcar system eventually had 190 miles of track that stretched through the Milwaukee area, but the era came to an end as buses and other modes of transportation became popular, and the electric company removed the tracks. Then about 2 years ago, work crews began laying down new tracks for the new streetcar. That's set to begin operation this November.
So why is it coming back?
Well, streetcars making a return in large part because of a big push from Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett. He thinks it'll be an important economic development tool, and the system is being created because of the city's commitment of $125 million. Most of that money is coming from federal funds and tax incremental financing. In addition, the Forest County Potawatomi is kicking in $10 million to the city over the course of 12 years. It'll offset operating costs and will allow free rides for the first year. As part of the deal, the Potawatomi community is a major sponsor of the system, which will be dubbed the HOP, presented by Potawatomi Hotel and Casino.
Well, that's a lot of stuff, and this is all for a streetcar that really, at this point, isn't that extensive.
Well, that's correct. This is for a 2-mile loop from downtown to the Lower East Side. There will be 5 streetcars circling the loop. Proponents hope to expand the system to the lakefront and perhaps other legs, such as north to UWM, if they can secure funding.
Well, I know that there are critics who might not want to see any of that happen. In fact, they're already upset with just that 2-mile loop.
That's right. Mayor Barrett and other proponents tout the fact that streetcar operational costs will be funded through a wide variety of sources, including eventually farebox revenue and things like advertising and sponsorships. They promise that property tax revenue will not be tapped for the system. Even so, opponents are concerned about the financial commitment that the city is taking on by creating the system, and they say there are more important things that the city should invest in. Arguments about these matters led to a contentious debate at the time that the Common Council approved the streetcar.
So what are some of the concerns that you're hearing now as we get close to the system actually becoming operational?
Well, some are coming from citizens. A number of bicyclists say they were injured when crossing the streetcar tracks. They say their tires got wedged in the tracks. Bicyclists have retained attorneys and have filed claims with the city. Others find it hard to believe that streetcars, cyclists, pedestrians, and drivers will be able to coexist safely.
I do have this like safety concern with bikes because I know already there's like a bike problem in Milwaukee with like people getting hit and like cars watching out, and the trolley's just going to add like an extra distraction for drivers.
That's Michaela Campbell, who lives near the streetcar route and has been thinking about the issue. I met her outside the Milwaukee Public Market on Water Street, which is right on the streetcar line.
So how is the city responding to all of these complaints and concerns?
Well, Mayor Barrett acknowledges the streetcar could take some getting used to. He commented recently when the last of the five streetcars was delivered to the city.
We think it's going to be a change, but it's a change that people will become accustomed to. Again, the tracks are there. Cars can drive over these tracks. Obviously, we've had a few issues with bicyclists or motorcyclists.
The city is advising cyclists to approach tracks at a 90-degree angle instead of traveling alongside them. And city engineer Jeff Polensky says a public education effort is underway. To make sure everyone understands what to do when riding, walking, or driving near the streetcar.
Rules of the road are essentially the same. So there are a couple locations where we have exclusive lanes to the streetcar. In those locations, motorists will find some unique signage that will indicate to not follow the streetcar into those lanes.
Polensky says streetcars will have to follow traffic signals just like cars do. A detailed list of rules and possible scenarios can be found on MilwaukeeStreetcar.org.
So what else is going on now in these weeks leading up to the launch of the service?
Well, testing of the vehicles is underway and drivers are being trained. And Department of Public Works officials may soon be appearing before aldermen to answer a wide variety of questions about streetcar safety. Alderman Mark Borkowski has been an outspoken critic of the streetcar project. He says he intends to ask the DPW officials to talk to aldermen at a Public Works Committee meeting before November. Borkowski wants to be assured that all potential safety concerns are being addressed, including how the streetcar will be affected by things like deep snow and ice storms.
That's Marty Michelson from the WUWM Newsroom. You can find more coverage of the Milwaukee streetcar at WUWM.com.
Keep listening. After a break, we'll talk with a writer about how to lay the groundwork for aging in place. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. According to the AARP, at least 90% of people in a recent survey say they want to age in their own home. But sometimes health and mobility issues can make that hope a challenge.
Linda Schrager has committed most of her professional life to helping people and families navigate this phase of life. Schrager has more than 37 years of experience working in the field of geriatrics, with over a decade of that spent in direct home care. Her book is Age in Place, a guide to modifying, organizing, and decluttering mom and dad's home. The book suggests guidelines and offers tools for readers to help make good choices and to arrive at a living situation that works well for seniors and their caregivers.
Schrager notes there are often signs that aging parents could need help, but Schrager says it's important to address those situations and have a conversation of what should we do in a respectful manner.
Schrager joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski and started by explaining what activities of daily living, or ADLs, are and how they affect the equation.
Well, activities of daily living, those are the kinds of things that we, all of us, do every single day. We toilet ourselves, we wash ourselves, brush our teeth, complete our grooming and hygiene, feed ourselves, bathe, and transfer. So, in other words, get from one surface to the other safely. Those are the ADLs. The instrumental ADLs are more, a little higher up. They take a little bit more cognitive functioning and physical functioning. So that, for example, is making a meal, doing the laundry, cleaning the house, going out to get the mail and the newspaper, taking out the garbage. Those are the IADLs, using the phone, managing meds, medications, that type of thing.
Many seniors are probably reluctant to admit that living at home is becoming difficult, but how do you broach this conversation, this question of what do we do appropriately? You know, what are the requirements from all parties involved to go about this in an organized and respectful manner?
Well, you know what? The respectful manner was a very important word, and I'm glad that you said that, because there are so many things out there these days that we're having the situation where the kids feel like they're parenting their parents now. And I try to tell the people that I work with that that's really not true, and it never should be true, that our parents are our parents, and we need to respect them no matter what, and give them the respect that they deserve. So going into the conversation with that in mind is a first really good step. And what happens is we don't tend to broach the subject for so many different reasons, because we feel it's uncomfortable, because we're worried what mom and dad might think. But the key to the whole thing, and what I talk about in my book, if people get nothing else out of it, they should get that. Don't wait for the crisis to occur. Don't wait till dad breaks his hip or mom has a heart attack and they're in the hospital and now they're going to come home and the house is on two levels and it's difficult for them to manage and there's no help and there's no plan in place. So the key to the whole thing is to sit down while everybody's healthy, while there is no crisis occurring, and say, look, mom and dad, the way to do this is to gather data first. The kids should go to mom and dad's house, and it's not just one visit, it's a few visits, and actually watch them go through the house, literally from getting out of the car, going up the steps, into the home, and all through the house, in the kitchen, on and off the couch, on in and out of the bathroom, on and off the bed, etc. And really keep an eye on them and see how they do with all of the activities of daily living, and then gather that data and information. Then say to mom and dad, we need to have a talk. We're worried about you, and you always bring it on yourself. You don't say, you guys are not safe, or, you know, you're going to have a problem. You say, we are worried. We love you. We care about you. And we want to have a conversation to share with you the data that we've gathered, to share with you our observations that maybe some of the things that you're doing have become difficult and you're not doing them as safely as you could. But the good news is we're all on the same page that we want to help you stay in this house. So what we want to do is sit calmly and organize a plan so that you can, in fact, stay here. So assuming, and by the way, the first thing should be, what are your wishes, mom and dad? Because we're assuming that they want to stay there. AARP has done tons of research and has noted that at least 90% of people want to age in their own home where they are. So we need to decide that that is, in fact, true. And if that is their wishes, then we say, look, we can help you. There's tons of things that we can do in this house, modifications that we can make, help that we might need to bring in to keep you here safely. So it shouldn't, in the end, be a stressful conversation, because it's not like we're saying you're on your way to assisted living, mom and dad. What we're saying is we want to keep you home. We want to help you.
So when these conversations have been had and, say, someone calls in your help to help establish a safe environment, when you walk up to a client's house, what are you looking for to make changes, or what are you seeing that already makes it safe?
Well, I literally get out of my car and look at the driveway where I put my car and start from there. So I will go, let's say, in through the front door. I'll look at the steps and the front porch and the entrance area. There's often problems right there. You want to look to see the height. Some of the older homes, you know, the steps aren't even maybe to code if they're really older homes and they're too high, or they've started to crumble a little bit. So You want to look there. Is there a good railing? It's always helpful to have two instead of one, one on both sides. And then when we get up to the front door, is it a high threshold to get in from the landing into the house? And then I start going through the house room by room. What I do, though, is I do this with the person involved. So you might be able to, you know, jog through your house without any problems at all. But my 80-year-old client might be toddling around a little bit, dragging her walker, and I want to see how she does in each room. So I will literally have her go into the living room, sit down on the furniture. That's often a problem. But you know what's interesting? The second highest amount of falls in a home occur in the living room, which people would never guess usually. But the reason why is because of the furniture. It's low, it's mushy, it's hard to get off of. So I'll look at things like that, and then I will maybe make a simple suggestion of taking the coffee table, pushing it out 6 inches, 8 inches, and it can make all the difference in the world. Go through into the kitchen. The kitchen is another biggie. A lot of things can happen in the kitchen, and a lot of time is spent in the kitchen. It's an important room. So I'll look at how the person is doing in the kitchen. Often the problem is that the cabinets are just way too high, especially as we get older and we get a little shorter. I'll look at the things that they have and see where they've placed the items that they use the most and suggest that they'll take the things that they do use the most and put them on the first shelf or even on the counter. It's okay to leave your most used things right out where you can access them versus fighting every day to reach that plate or bending way down in a low cabinet to get that favorite pot out. You know, I'll see the placement of the stove, how the refrigerator is, and maybe make suggestions. One of the big obstacles, of course, in any home is if it's a two-story home. That's a red flag to me that this could be trouble down the line. There are so many things that one can do, though, if that's the case. First of all, if they have a full bath on the first floor, that's the key. Then they can take a room, the dining room, the den, the office on the first floor, make that into a bedroom, and pretty much live on the first floor. And many people end up doing that if they can and if they cannot manage the stairs. If that's not a possibility, and if they want to get upstairs, there are stair lifts. And then the biggie is the bathroom. The bathroom is where most falls occur. And obviously, you would guess that because, first of all, there's a potential for a wet surface. And secondly, there's a lot of transfers going on. There are a lot of change in surface. They're walking in, they're sitting on the toilet, they're getting up off the toilet, they're getting into the shower, they're getting out of the shower. So there's many little problems that could happen in the bathroom. But again, very doable. There are many different devices, shower chairs, transfer benches. Of course, grab bars are probably the biggest modification that I find myself making in any home.
All of these physical changes to a home are relatively straightforward once you assess and see what needs to be done. And while aging in place is something we all want, what happens when we need that 24/7 care but can't afford it? Do you think it's more affordable to make these changes to be able to stay at home with physical changes and a network of people versus, say, a senior living facility or even a nursing home?
Well, you know, that is a good question. And it actually somewhat depends on where a person lives because assisted livings and nursing homes do vary by where they're located. That said, a nursing home can be very, very expensive. It can be average around $100,000 to $150,000, let's say $120,000 per year. So you need to figure that out as far as expenses are concerned. Assisted livings, they range from about $47,000 or $48,000 to about $60,000 a year. So then the question is if you get private help. Now, private help isn't inexpensive either. A home health aide in New York State, for example, 40 hours a week, not 24 a day, but half days, let's say even, is about $55,000. So the question is you do have to look at your expenses and figure it out. if you can make the modifications in the person's home, and if the person can afford part aids, maybe not 24/7, but they could perhaps get private pay help and augment that with some more creative things like family, friends, and neighbors. So there are some ways to creatively get help almost around the clock and keep them home.
Aging in place is not necessarily the same as dying in place, but do you think that this is what most people feel it transitions to, or that this is what they want? You know, with today's medical needs and advancements, you know, has that made our declines and subsequent deaths, you know, worse and a little more complicated? You know, whereas, say, 80 years ago, it might have been more straightforward.
Well, this is true. I mean, you know, the whole healthcare arena has changed, and there are so many movements out there now that are saying that we do too much, you know, that we have such advanced care available that we keep people going for too long and we spend too much money keeping them going, when in fact, if we, you know, kind of let nature take its course, it might be a better way to go. So certainly, you know, that could be an issue. We are living longer because technology and medical advances are keeping us around longer. And unfortunately, the flip side of that is the caregivers are getting less. We have less people out there in the arena to care for all these people who are getting old and sick. People, yes, back in the day, their thought was to just, you know, I opened the book by saying that I'm an occupational therapist and I do home care. So I treat people in their homes, most often after something acute has happened, a broken hip, a knee replacement, a stroke, a heart attack. And I went into this one person's house and she said, I just want you to know that I'm going out of this house horizontally or not at all. So that was her. And then I opened the book with that because I'll never forget Josie and her statement to me. And I got that. But, you know, that's and that is what people hope for. But, you know, medically and with all these advances, obviously the sicker someone is and the more medical care they need, that might not be possible anymore.
Right. And sometimes things happen at home where then transfer to a hospital is required. So what kind of paperwork, key things that should be filed somewhere, how should that be organized and to let the kids know of the parents where this is so that it's easily accessible and ultimately done before something acute happens?
That's such a good question. And first of all, I talk about making a healthcare notebook. And that's such a simple thing where you just literally take a three-ring binder and you get it together. And in that binder, you put all the important health information. So the list of doctors, the list of medications, the list of hospitals, the diagnoses, the medical and surgical history, and all of those things, and doctor's notes when applicable. And that's a binder that I feel that people should keep. I say to people, make what I call Command Central, which is a place in the house, which can be anything. It can be a table, a desk, you know, the top of a dresser that's been cleared off, whatever it is. But everybody knows that's Command Central, and that's where you go to find all of this information. So that's a great way of keeping everybody on the same page. Then the other thing is, in the back of this book, I call it the mother list, vital documents that you need to be able to locate. And then that goes through the legal things such as the will, the power of attorney, the healthcare proxy, alternates, insurance information, and their, you know, if they have a long-term care policy, etc., any supplemental policies, and then identifying information, where's their Social Security, vital records, etc., etc., etc. And, you know, that list can be a little overwhelming, but the key is if someone is home and they're healthy and they're doing well, if they can take this vital documents list and make a map for their children or their loved ones of where all these papers are, it is really, really life-changing.
You mentioned before people don't often like to broach this subject because it's uncomfortable or it's broached a little too late after something happens. What are some key things for us to keep in mind when weighing options of helping those we love age in place? And how do we change the narrative to have these discussions sooner?
Well, so that's the thing. If what we want to do is we want to gather that data and we want to note, because, you know, nobody wants to admit that they're feeling sick or they're having a problem until they really have that problem. So it's important that there's a good family dynamic, that the kids do visit and they do go see mom and dad. And they, and you know, I make a suggestion, take a walk with your parent through the house as if you've never been there before. Kind of look at it with fresh eyes and have this dialogue. This isn't the kind of thing where you can do long distance without really seeing your parents. And when you get all those little pieces of information in a row and you're getting your ducks in a row, that's when you have to say, you know what, we need to have a talk. And it might not be comfortable to start the conversation, but it's worth not to have it. You know, there's a lot of things that we have to deal with in our life that might not always be comfortable, but that's not a reason or an excuse not to have the conversation.
Linda Schrager is a registered occupational therapist, a master's level social worker, and a certified aging in place specialist. She's also author of the book Age in Place, a guide to modifying, organizing, and decluttering mom and dad's home. She spoke with Audrey Nowakowski, and you can find out more information and helpful tips at WUWM.com.
We'll take another break now, and then a musician shares his visual artist side. A conversation with Alberto Villalobos when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. If you know the name Alberto Villalobos, it's probably for his music as one-third of the ensemble Villalobos Brothers. They're best known for their contemporary take on traditional Mexican music.
For the past year, Villalobos has been teaching violin and viola in the Latino Arts String Program, and that's also given him the opportunity to display a solo show of his mask-making and ceramic work. It's called Hombres de Arcilla, or Men of Clay, and it commemorates the disappearance of 40 students in Mexico in 2014.
Villalobos and his partner, Wisconsin native Megan Van Aan, joined me in the studio to talk about the show. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much, Bonnie.
Thank you so much for having us.
So, Alberto, most people know you as a musician first. You and your brothers have a wonderful band. And I think it was the band that first brought you to Latino arts. Is that correct?
That's right. That's correct, Bonnie. Me and my brothers have a family band for many years now. And I think it was four years ago that we came to Summer Grounds to play at Mexican Fiesta. And that was when we listened to the kids from Latino Arts Strings Program. And we met Dinora Marquez, the wonderful and dear friend that directs the program.
Yeah, she's fantastic. She's been on this show so many times, you know, and we've had the kids, we've recorded them performing, and they're so good.
They are excellent.
They're so good.
And I happen to be a mentor now for them, and a teacher for violin and viola and groups. And I'm really proud of the work that we are doing there and really happy to be keep on collaborating with Dinora now.
How are you managing to do that and still have your tour schedule? Because you're here full time now.
Yeah, it's complicated. I have to wear many hats. I have to find time to continue creating my visual art, which is why we're here. But also touring with my brothers is very important. And I think Dinora has been really supportive about this cause. We fight for social justice, and through music, we have a really powerful voice that can invite people to change and to create a better understanding, a better world.
Well, especially now.
That's
it's
right.
A very difficult time for Mexican Americans and for Mexicans in this country. Do you find that you are really pulled to speak about that and sing about that?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a very important moment. And we need to speak up. It's just the right thing to do. Recently, I was a citizen of the United States. Last year, I became a citizen.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. And I'm really proud now to say that this country has given me so many opportunities to grow as an artist, as a musician, as a person. I met Megan here, and I'm working in a wonderful organization, Latino Art Strings, in Milwaukee, after living in New York City for more than 13 years. So this country has really all these possibilities for artists that many people should know about.
Well, you mentioned visual art, and I think that might be an aspect of your career that a lot of people don't know about, that you're also a visual artist and a very passionate one. And there's an exhibit going on right now at Latino Arts in the gallery that's right next to the performance stage. And Megan, I'm going to bring you in now because you helped him curate this.
I did.
So tell me about, first of all, how you got together in terms of working on this particular exhibit.
Sure. So I think I'll sort of take credit for Alberto getting into clay.
What were you doing before?
Paper mache.
Okay.
Paintings and paper mache masks.
Murals.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm an art educator, and I always felt that as an art educator, that 3D art was sort of like writing with my non-dominant hand, with my left hand, so to speak. And so I thought I should not run away from it. I'm going to throw myself into it. I'm really curious about pottery. And so I started taking pottery classes and working with clay. And Alberto saw me working with clay, and he's like, this is incredible. I want to work with clay, too. So we started going to the same pottery studio in New York City. And I think clay really offered you the opportunity to work in a way that painting and paper mache sort of had certain limits that you felt restrained by, and clay really allowed you to make something different.
Well, yeah, because you were already working three-dimensionally
That's right.
with paper mache, but what does clay offer that paper mache did not?
Well, I think working with clay is just different to anything else I've done before, and I kind of fell in love with the feeling of the clay in your hands and how it changes texture when it's wet, when it gets dry. And then eventually with the process of firing a piece and how the fire makes a piece become permanent, right? Because before a piece is fired, it's very fragile. It can crumble back to the ground. And once it's fired, it lasts for forever. You know, we found pieces from the Olmecs, from the Egyptians, and they're still there. So if you don't break them physically, they're fragile, but also very durable. That's what I wanted to say. And I kind of find the analogy with life, you know, how surviving or going through those struggles make you stronger and make you who you are after being able to experience that.
Being tested by the fires.
Exactly.
Literally.
Life, literally.
Yeah. So when I heard about, I met one of the parents from these missing students in Mexico, it was only natural. At the time, I was starting to work with clay, and I was already making masks in different medias. And I said, I remember I told you, Megan, I told you, I'm going to build masks for every one of these single individuals.
And you should probably tell us who these students are, because I think a lot of people in this country might not know.
Yeah,
that's right. So back in 2014, there was this very sad situation, sad events that happened in Mexico in the state of Guerrero, where 43 students from a rural school, we're talking about teenagers.
A
teacher's college called Raúl Isidro Burgos in Guerrero, were attacked by the police, the municipal police of Iguala, and they were disappeared. And this is 4 years ago exactly, on the 26th of September. So this is unacceptable. You know, we're talking about people here. I think most importantly, what happened that night is a tip of an iceberg showing. And the big problem is the impunity and the bureaucracy that permeates every single aspect of Mexican political life. So that crime that goes unpunished for 4 years and the families suffering for 4 years, it's really heartbreaking. And I think through this exhibit and through many other attempts, artists and activists are seeking justice 4 years later.
So you have made masks of all of these people who have been killed by the police.
Well, it's a touchy subject because talking to the parents, they don't think, they don't have the evidence to support that they're dead. So if you talk to them, they ask them, they chant in protest, they say, vivos se los llevaron, vivos los queremos. They took them alive, we want them alive. So they refuse to believe that they are dead because they haven't found any remains of the students.
So there's no evidence?
There's no evidence. They only found one of the students, Mondragon, that they kept in a black bag, in a trash bag, under a chair. And one of the pictures that my friend took from Ayotzinapa is that picture of, it's in the exhibit. And to me, that's unacceptable. That's inhuman. That's something that we as a society shouldn't allow to happen. And also by not bringing closure to the families and giving them the peace of mind that their loved ones are found, it's an unacceptable truth for them. You know, they are going to clinch to the slightest possibility of finding them alive, as they should, until they're found. And in the process of finding them, they've been just by themselves organizing the community and digging in different parts of Iguala, and they found many other bodies, more than 100 bodies, buried in clandestine common
mass graves,
but none of them are the ones of the 43 students
or their
daughters,
their
sons.
Yeah,
they were all male, their sons. So as I told you, like, this is the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot of things going on in Mexico that we're talking about. 98% of crimes go
unpunished or never brought to justice in Mexico.
So high numbers.
In terms of impunity and conviction, Mexico ranks up with Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan.
Wow.
So I think that's something that a lot of Americans aren't aware of, things that are happening right across our border.
Right. And you have sort of this blanket acceptance on the government's part that this is okay. This is how we operate. Yeah.
It's either okay or they're actually involved. They are actually part of it.
Yeah, I guess that's part of the problem when you don't have the confidence to speak up because you're afraid that there's going to be consequences if you denounce, if you go to the police.
You will disappear. Yeah.
So it's incredible, really. And especially, you know, growing up in Mexico, I grew up there until I was 18 years old, and looking how beautiful the country is and how much it has to offer to the world, how much culture and tradition and it's now being labeled by this climate of violence that is ongoing, really, for the last 10, 15 years.
When you put this artwork into a place like Latino Arts and you're also teaching the young students music, and you know, you're sharing both of those parts of your expression with them, what are the questions they ask you?
You mean the students?
The students, yeah.
Well, it's very important to have the gallery at Latino Arts because, as you know, it's next to the school, to the elementary school and to the middle school. So students come to the gallery and visit the gallery with their art class. And they have really interesting questions. One of them, this just opened on Friday, so it's very recent.
Yeah.
But I will do some guided tours with the students. I'm not sure which grades have been to the exhibit, but just recently one of them like stopped me in the hallway and told me, "Mr. Alberto," he said, "like I really like your artwork. I was wondering if you could explain to me a little bit more about it." You know, they are interested because clay is mysterious like that. It gets stained by the fire, and it kind of gets its own personality after. There's a sense of abandonment when you fire a piece. You don't really know what's going to happen unless you're using really specific techniques. But especially if you wood fire pieces, they're going to turn out
They have a mind of their own.
Exactly. Yeah. And the student seems to be very curious about that. What do you mean? Why do you name it like you named it? I gave them, instead of names, I gave them names of feelings. So one of them, for instance, is called peace. Or one of them, it's called llanto, you know, like cry. Or so I didn't want to name them, but I did want to give them a feeling, a general sense of the feeling that the parents or the families or even us as spectators might be experiencing.
So how does working with the clay and working with the music work together for you, particularly at Latino Arts, because you're teaching mm-hmm. and then you're also exhibiting as an artist?
That's right. Yeah, well, this whole project, I think it started over 3 years ago, what I call Hombres de Arcilla, Men of Clay. And it started with a song, actually. I wrote a song, and it took me forever to finally have the determination to bring it over to my brothers. And we recorded it very recently. Well, not so recently, last year. But the album is still not out. So I cannot play the song, even if I wanted to, because the album hasn't been released. But this started and sparked the will to do more and to bring it to the visual arts field. And
are you hoping to take the artwork on tour as well?
Yeah. So this, we were trying to think of how many places it's been now. So it initially opened in the Bronx, and we were lucky enough to partner with an organization, a nonprofit in the South Bronx, where there were several girls who had also disappeared and their remains had never been found. So it was a really interesting connection between things that had actually been happening in the Bronx as well. So it's been in the Bronx. It's been in D.C., Washington, D.C., in Portland as part of the National Ceramics Conference. And there was a piece and a show in Dallas last year as well.
Right. And now it's here.
And now it's here in Milwaukee.
I was also in Lake George.
We performed
there and we took some pieces. So it's a traveling exhibit, but as a solo exhibit, it's been only in a couple of places, Washington, the Bronx, and here. Because it's you can imagine that there are more than 40 pieces, very fragile. They're big pieces too.
You don't want them to return to dust before their time.
Before their time. Even though we have had that some casualties in the way. I had them in a restaurant in Midtown Manhattan. And when I went back to pick them up, three of them were gone mysteriously. So I was really upset and really sad. But then I realized, I think you made me realize about that, how the parents, for them, it's their sons, you know. And I was okay with that. Yeah. I just built new masks and they're here. They live here in Milwaukee now.
So now that you've spent a year here, are you going to stick around? Are you going to stay and make music here with the students?
I hope so. I certainly hope so. It's been a very intense year of work and touring and making masks. But I'm really happy and I feel welcome. I feel that Milwaukee has a very welcoming community. Wonderful food. I can't complain for that part either. So I'm really happy here.
And Megan, this is sort of a homecoming for you. You're from Oshkosh.
From Oshkosh, but I'm a graduate of Marquette University. So we certainly didn't plan on moving back to Milwaukee, but Denora made it happen. So really thanks to her for bringing us back. And I'm really happy to be back and see how much the city has grown and changed in the 10 years that I've gone. Nothing but better things I've seen.
And it's nice to know that you think the food is good. Because I think it's really good here too.
Yeah.
You'll have to tell me some of the best places.
Absolutely. I also want to say Raul was really helpful in bringing the exhibit here and kind of using his expertise to guide me and to suggest the final placement of the pieces. I had a different idea, but when I talked to him, I kind of switched directions and this is how the gallery looks nowadays because he was kind enough to come and see it and
He's really good too. So yeah, between him and Denora, you know, sort of a power couple.
Right. Yeah, I think they've really taken us under their wings as a art and musicians. We couldn't be in the hands of really a better Milwaukee power couple.
There you go. Well, I am so thrilled to meet you both. I am so glad you were able to come on to the show. I'm looking forward to seeing the exhibit, and I can't thank you enough.
Thank you so much for having us, Bonnie.
Alberto Villalobos is one-third of the musical trio, Villalobos Brothers. He's also been teaching violin and viola at Latino Arts this year and currently has an exhibit of ceramic works on display called Hombres de Arcilla at the UCC. Megan Van Ahn is Villalobos' partner and curator of the exhibit. You can find pictures and more information at WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break, and then Bubbler Talk asks a fundamental question about the name of a famous road in the Milwaukee area. We'll find out what it is when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR.
More of Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
All right, so there are three types of people in this world. Those who notice nothing, those who notice but don't care to question, and then there are those who ask why. Most of us are each of those people every day. That's where this guy comes in.
I'm David Wagner. I'm sorry, what are you doing? Do you want me to ask my question?
Yeah, so we are sitting in your truck outside a BP gas station in Caledonia, right off 7 Mile Road exit. Why are we here? You submitted a question to Bubbler Talk, and what was that?
My question was, what is 7 Mile Road 7 miles from?
Right now, we're just off I-94, 20 minutes south of Milwaukee. Now, after seeing David's question, my first thought was, well, that's an easy answer, Lake Michigan. Like with everything these days, a coworker and I decided to consult Google, and Google said, definitely not Lake Michigan. If any of you are snickering right now, just know I'm not ashamed to be wrong, but we still don't have the answer to David's question. The next logical step was to rope David in on this. I asked him to meet us at the 7 Mile Road exit so we could take a ride. If you haven't guessed by now, we drove 7 miles one direction to see where we ended up. Scientific, right?
That's
so
right.
This is lots of undeveloped land right now. And we are on Frontage Road, is that correct?
Yes, we're on the East Frontage Road heading south.
All right. And so right next to us, we're running parallel to the interstate.
Correct.
And wait, where are we starting? What miles are you at on your vehicle?
Oh, that's a very good question. We're at 946.2 when we started.
All right.
Okay, so you'll see here, we're now passing 6.5 Mile Road.
All right.
So we're going somewhere.
But exactly where was that somewhere?
Well, we're still a half mile.
Half mile away. We got to keep going.
Yeah. And it's still fields and traffic.
Yep, pretty much. It's like that movie, Are We There Yet? 0.2 miles later, and we were actually there, just south of Highway 20.
There's a Toyota car dealership.
Toyota dealership. I'm not sure that was here when 7 Mile Road was named.
And that's our 7 miles.
That's our 7 miles. Okay.
And Burger King, yeah.
Well, there's your answer.
There you go.
David was a little disappointed, so I decided to keep digging because we figured that couldn't be the real answer. That journey took me 9 miles east to the county courthouse in Racine to meet with Tom Friedel.
I'm retired. I am the former city administrator for the city of Racine.
You know those people who know everything? Tom is one of those. In fact, for the purposes of this story, let's call him Tom the All-Knowing.
I can answer a lot of questions, yes.
All right.
That's what you do when you're the city administrator. You answer a lot of questions.
And so basically, the question is, what is 7 Mile Road 7 miles from?
Well, we're standing at the corner of 7th and Wisconsin outside the Racine County Courthouse. So if you look down 7th Street, 7th Street runs, and it's a section line. When this territory was divided and surveyed, there were 1 mile sections created from the Illinois border all the way north. So in Racine County, the closest point to county government is right here at 7th and Wisconsin.
So what does county government have to do with any of this?
Well, county government would be the agency that runs and sets up the lines and the borders and all of the municipal functions. Until someone becomes a city, then they take over that. responsibility.
So basically what you're saying, 7 Mile Road is supposed to be 7 miles from the seat of county government.
Well, it's not supposed to be, it just happens to be.
Okay.
So there's a section line that runs here. There's another one a mile away, and a mile away, and a mile away. You count 7 miles, and you will be at 7 Mile Road.
Tom says street names obviously came later.
Support for this season's Bubbler Talk comes from Educators Credit Union, a member-owned credit union dedicated to helping those who live and work in Wisconsin make informed financial decisions. More at ecu.com. What's got you scratching your head about the Milwaukee area? Submit your question at wuwm.com/bubblertalk.
And that's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Bonnie and I produce the show along with Audrey Nowakowski, Joy Powers, and assistant producer Maddie Andre. We get additional support from digital producer Lauren Sigfusson and our team of specialty reporters.
Susan Bentz, Taryn Powell, Chuck Kornbach, and Emily Files. We also get engineering help from Jason Reavy, and Michelle Matternowski is the managing editor.
Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh Air is next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.